The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and Lit Hub Radio. Hello. America, America, America. The name itself, based on an oddity, an Italian explorer who was not the first to discover the place, obviously, while the place was inhabited. But he wasn't the first European to discover it either. Amerigo Vespucci wasn't in the part of America that we now know as the United States. He was likely in Brazil and perhaps Mexico, and some of his historical accounts need to put historical in quotes. But if you're going to take a name that doesn't belong, take one from an Italian, because their names are so pretty. America is a beautiful word, and at times it has been a beautiful place with beautiful ideas, beautiful dreams, beautiful promise. At other times, it's filled with something less beautiful. We don't need to enumerate the darknesses. They are in our history and culture, ancient past and instant present. America is revered, and America is contested, and it has a literature that reflects it all. Or does it? What exactly is America, and what is American literature? That's the subject of a book by our guest today called, appropriately enough, What is American Literature? Professor Ilan Stavins, today on the History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast, everyone. I am Jack Wilson, American podcaster, I suppose you might say. I don't have much else to claim, and I don't have anywhere to hide. My cousin told me once that I could have had a second passport, thanks to my two Swiss grandparents, which he shared. Our moms didn't do it, he told me, because of the fee. My cousin is a world traveler who has been almost everywhere. He's been roaming the planet for about 30 years now, and even so, he lamented not having that Swiss passport. We could go anywhere, he said. Imagine, Cuba, Iran. Those were the two places on his list that I remember back when we had that conversation, and by then the loophole had closed and we were not allowed to be Swiss anymore. The fee, he moaned. Oh, it was like $10, he moaned. And so we were not Swiss. We were Americans, Americans only, for better or worse, like it or lump it, with nowhere else to hide and no one else to be. America is as wild as a kaleidoscope. It's different for everyone. It's a place and a state of mind. One comes at it from all angles, or maybe I should say everyone has their own angle. And they approach it from that angle, and so America is being approached at all different angles all at once, all the time. How does one begin to define such a place? And literature itself is pretty slippery. So how do we dig in? Well, here at the History of Literature podcast, we look for help. One such guide comes in the form of this book that's in my hand now, What is American Literature? By the professor, cultural critic, and literature expert, Ilan Stavins, the Lewis Sebring Professor in Latin American and Latino College and Five College 40th Anniversary Professor at Amherst College. He's the publisher at Restless Books and the host of the NPR podcast, In Contrast. He's also the author of many books. In this one, he takes a look at American literature as a gateway to many topics, almost said tapioca, many topics. We don't have tapioca of interest. We have topics of interest, including where did the idea of America as exceptional come from? Yes. Is this exceptionalism something we still do? Is it current or part of the past? What keeps Americans reinventing themselves? Those are good questions. And he asks the key questions for us today. Is the literature Americans have produced exceptional? In what ways? Might it be said to constitute a collective memory? Does it pass through generations, or do we forget over and over? Is America distracted? Does it care or not? Those are big subjects. I'm not sure we cover all those with Professor Stavins, but that's what his book is for. We'll give you a taste of his thinking and his project. Anyway, Ilan Stavins and American Literature after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Hello, everyone. This is Jack here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Okay, joining me now is Professor Ilan Stavins of Amherst College, a cultural critic and author of many books, including What is American Literature? A Meditation on a Nation's Identity Through the Prism of Its Books. Professor Stavins, welcome to the History of Literature.
I am delighted to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So I'd like to start with you, if I could. Where did you grow up?
I am a native of the Mexico City. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, part of a small immigrant enclave, Eastern European Jews from Belarus, Ukraine, Poland, Russia, that had made their way at the beginning of the 20th century. And up until the Second World War, I am a grandchild of some of those newcomers to Mexico.
Right. Well, I think we will get into that soon because it sounds like you have a great vantage point for seeing across cultures, and especially when addressing something like what is American literature, you're probably drawing on all kinds of perspectives. But before we get to that, I just wanted to ask you what kind of a reader you were as a child. When did you start reading literature, or when did you start noticing that this was something you wanted to devote your life to?
I was a rather apathetic reader in my young teenage years. Yeah. The allure was the outdoors, not the life of the mind. It, something clicked, though, at the end of that decade for me. And maybe as I was reaching 18, 19, 20, I discovered books. And the, especially, I remember the kind of feverish discovery of a couple of novels, one of them, 100 Years of Solitude, that utterly transformed me. And since then, I have never left the page, either as a reader or trying to build one for other readers.
Wow. Do you remember what it was about 100 Years of Solitude that struck you so strongly?
I do. It seemed to me that that book, which I read in, I think, 18 hours straight, without sleep, without hardly eating anything, had created a reality that was more complex and interesting than mine, than ours, one that I wanted to inhabit with its own laws, with its own texture. And I was absolutely mesmerized by the capacity of an author to become a godlike creature who could invent a world with such magic and with such biodiversity. And that early impression never left me. I always longed for that type of enraptured experience that I had. You know, often I am a devoted reader, but a distracted reader. I go into a book and then jump into another. That reading of 100 Years of Solitude was unimpeded by anything. And in that sense, it was pure and it was supreme.
Yeah. Do you think you could have an experience like that today after you've read all of the literature? I'm thinking you were probably a pretty, I don't want to say naive reader, but now that you've read so much literature, you probably look at it as you see more of the mechanics, or you're placing it within a tradition, or you have maybe a different experience toward literature. Or do you think do you find that you're able to recreate that magic of just being a pure reader?
I long for that magic, and on occasion, that magic comes back, though seldom with a new book.
Yeah.
What that magic to me is in most recent years, and because I have reached my 60s, is the return to some classics that I am drawn to, and I'm able to experience on a third, fourth, fifth, 20th reading of, say, Don Quixote or the Odyssey or certain plays of Shakespeare, that out of the world experience that in some ways mimics what I went through when I was a teenager.
Right. Oh, that's fascinating. That's kind of what I've experienced as well, but enough about me. let's talk about American literature. Did you move to America, or were you looking, did you start reading American literature or thinking about American literature before you left Mexico City?
In Mexico, I don't remember reading American literature, and by American, I mean U.S. literature, in any consistent or guided way. I stumbled upon a few books here and there, mainly the recommendation either of a friend or of a writer that I had read who had elevated a particular book above all others. It was systematic, it was chaotic, and for that reason, it was delightful. It wasn't as if I was studying American literature. I was simply entering the many doors of that building that is this country's literature in a haphazard, spontaneous, very personal way. And of course, in that period, it was mostly not in English. It was in other languages. It was in Spanish or in Hebrew or in another language that I would have access to. And only later did I go to the original, just as I was about to leave Mexico and wander through Europe. I remember reading Moby Dick, for instance, in a Spanish translation. And I thought that it was a magnificent Latin American novel, not an American novel, but a Latin American one in its breadth, in its encyclopedic scope, also in the way it traveled the world. It didn't seem to me to be as self-centered as other types of American literature that I had encountered at that time. And I also remember reading for the very first time a book that struck me deeply, but I don't think I understood it. I still don't believe I fully understand it today. And that is Mark Twain's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. To me, that is the beginning of American literature, the kind of centerpiece. And when I first encountered it in Mexico, again, in a translation, it seemed to me to have been displayed in a bookstore as an adolescent book, and I took it as such. I didn't see its complexity, the nuances of the language. I don't remember how the Spanish translation was able or not to convey that the difficulty of Jim's parlance, which is probably the most challenging aspect that any translator of that book faces. Mm-hmm. But I was struck by that friendship between Huck and Jim, what it meant, and the fact that the whole novel was a journey. I loved it then, didn't return to that book for many years, but it was sitting in my memory very comfortably, in some ways asking to be revisited, in which I did maybe 30 years later, and rediscovered it.
Let's take a quick break, and then we will come back. I want to ask you, we'll try to see if we can define what we're talking about when we talk about American literature, and we'll see why Huckleberry Finn is such a good example of it. Okay, we are back with Professor Ilan Stavins. I'm always worried I'm going to pronounce it wrong. I hope I'm not butchering.
You're doing a good job.
Okay, good. No. So let's start with this. When we talk about American literature, you corrected me, or you clarified when I said American literature that you were referring to U.S. literature. In terms of your book, What is American Literature? Do you set any geographical or time period boundaries when you're defining what's in and what's out?
No, I don't. And precisely that is the effort that I am hoping to achieve.
Yeah.
To try to erase the boundaries, to mm-hmm. see how the boundaries have kept on shifting, to wonder to what degree the word America really speaks about the nation's literature, what other nations and what other literatures can come under the same rubric. What is it that we are trying to convey when we use that term American literature? Is it something that is written in English exclusively? Is it written by Americans that live in the United States? Can it be immigrants? Can it be expats? Could it be about America, but not written by an American, meaning a U.S. Citizen, all those aspects are very attractive to me.
Right. So if we're going to, in some ways, the bright lines of saying, okay, we'll just start in 1776 and we'll make it United States literature and we'll include the continental U.S. and so on, that would in some ways make it easier. There might be some people who emigrated or lived in two countries, or someone like T.S. Eliot might be a judgment call, but it would make it a lot easier. But it's a lot more interesting if we're looking at it more in terms of a state of mind or a set of common themes. So what are the qualities that to you would help make it an American literature?
Mm-hmm. I want to preface my answer to your question by bringing forth another book that I was writing more or less at the same time. It was also published by Oxford University Press, and is concurrent in the queries that I was applying to what is American literature. And that is a small meditation on Jewish literature. Mm. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because to me, Jewish literature is a paradigm of spacelessness and lack of linguistic concentration that defines a clear, by which I mean a clearly demarcated tradition. Jewish literature can be written in French, can be written in Hebrew, can be written in Yiddish, can be written in Spanish, in Portuguese, in Italian. It can be written in any of those languages and in any of those countries where those languages are spoken. So a Jewish book might sit on the same shelf with another one that is in a different tongue by a writer that belongs to a different period, and nothing really might have brought them together other than the fact that they believe to share the same sensibility, the sensibility of being Jewish. They might not have been religious. They might not have been even committed to belonging to the Jewish community. And yet the questions of what it means to be Jewish and how that engages with, as a minority, with a larger environment, say the United States or France or Germany, is what defines that literature. In contrast, American literature strikes me as much more easy to define, and perhaps for that reason, much more square-minded. Mm. American literature is the literature that is produced by Americans within a particular period of time. You established it 1776, let's say, until the very present. And that is written also in English. But if we go deeper, we can find that there are, and you suggested one or more, writers that have been living as expats in, say, Paris, Hemingway, Alice Douglas, and others, who are John Dos Passos, mm-hmm. who are writing as Americans, but are not writing about America. They can be writing about the Spanish Civil War, the Second World War. There are also writers that are Americans that have switched languages, that began in English, but then switched to Italian, or the recent case of Jhumpa Lahiri, or immigrants that have come to the United States, got their green card, got their citizenship. I'm thinking here of Isaac Bashevis-Zinger, who won the Nobel Prize in 1978, but throughout his life, almost exclusively wrote in Yiddish, and everything that we read by him is in translation. So in this case, an American writer is a writer that arrives to us in a language that is not English, in a translated text, which is often something that we commonly connect with the idea that foreigners arrives to us in that sense. There's also a great tradition in American literature of writing about missionaries and writing into other parts of the world, about what being an American might mean during the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan, or explorations during the 19th century of the Caribbean or of Latin America or of Asia. So what I'm attracted is to this question of what makes all of these entities come together. Is there a gravitational force that defines us beyond the confines, the parameters, the perimeters of the nation itself with its borders? And I'm also very interested in this is I would say the result of having written What is American Literature, how the American language has changed over time. That is actually the topic of my next book, which is called The People's Tongue, Americans and the English Language. It's an anthology, a sprawling anthology that reflects the many changes that English has gone through from before the War of Independence to the very present, and the many types of internal voices that we hear when we're writing in English, say that Chinglish or in Spanglish or Yinglish, writers that are writing like Zora Neale Hurston or Henry Roth, that are writing in the English language, but making the language elastic in such a way so that a minority, say Blacks or Jews or Italians or the Chinese, can express themselves in something that is a hybrid tongue, neither here nor there, where a sentence can begin in Spanish and move into English, go back to Spanish, back and forth until you get a whole paragraph that is almost symmetrically balanced between the two languages. Is that still American literature? Is that part of Latin American literature because it's in Spanish and it's written by a Mexican or by somebody from Cuba? And to what extent do we use language as the prism or the entrance door to say this is part of what our conception of the nation is or isn't?
So when you're, just so I understand, it sounds like you're looking at kind of a combination. On the one hand, it's dependent on who is writing and how they view themselves and where they fit in a conception of America. And then you're also doing, I don't know if this is part of a search to find what American literature is, or if you're, once you take that group of books, then you're interested in seeing, well, do they have any common themes, or are there any ideas that we can see that would set this type of literature apart? So it sounds like you're kind of doing both of those things. Is that right?
Exactly. Both of those things. And trying to explore the degree to which the literature of this country is not only a form of entertainment and of instruction, but a mirror and a map and a compass of how we have understood ourselves, understand ourselves, and will in the future. And that is, I will say, kind of a legacy or an influence of my Mexican or writ large, my Latin American upbringing. In Latin America, in contrast with the United States, literature is seen as an instrument of change. The channel through which voices that are seldom recognized in the mainstream are able to express themselves, and that is charged with a lot of ideological messaging, and in many ways writers are also in Latin America psychologists, and they are activists. But they are also entertainers, and they are codifiers of what the country is thinking or exploring. In Latin America, figures like Borges or Pablo Neruda acquire a kind of prophetic status where by people follow them more passionately and more authentically than they follow a president or a senator, because they hear the clarion of their message louder and clearer. And I wanted to see if the same type of approach could be used to look at Melville and Emily Dickinson and Hawthorne and Twain, that is in the 19th century, but also writers of the 20th century. What do those books say about the country, about the nation, and in what way is that concept a moving target?
Yeah. And to see if they reflect certain ideas that Americans have about themselves, or whether they are actually moving to create those self-conceptions or challenge them.
Absolutely. To see if they reflect those ideas. But I want to add one more element that in my book, I think is where I tend to stress. I think that literature is not what the author intends. I think that literature is what the reader gets from what the author intended.
Yeah.
And in many ways, what is American literature seeks to achieve is a kind of a history of American readers. Who have been the readers who have opened up Huckleberry Finn and Emily Dickinson's poems and Uncle Tom's Cabin and The Beloved and many other books? In what way their reaction to the books has made them feel part of the club, or they have been left behind? And when they have been left behind, in what capacity have they felt that it is their duty to add to that concert of voices? So it's, to me, what is often left behind when we think about literature is what is most important, the reader, the readers, the many readers. And that is what I seek to decipher in the book. Who has been reading a Huckleberry Finn, and how have they been seeing this book? How have they been connecting the dots with the previous readers and the readers that are yet to come?
Yeah. Let's take a specific example. The one that I was trying to get my mind around as I was going through your book was American exceptionalism. And I see that in, it's easy for me to spot that in politicians and their rhetoric. And sometimes they're self-aware enough to recognize that that's what they're doing. And often they just take it for granted and they just will apply that notion that America is the best or America is different, America is special, all of that. When it comes to literature, did you find or do you think that authors are contesting that? Are they trying to create that view? Or is it just they're sort of reflecting it as if it's part of the air around them, so to speak?
My view is that American writers look at this heavy burden of what makes this nation exceptional and try to decipher it from all sorts of perspectives, sometimes with a very skeptical eye, thinking there's nothing that makes us different from anybody else, either our contemporaries or empires that came before us. And in other cases, they take it to extremes. They use it, as in the case of, say, The Great Gatsby, or even Moby Dick, where bigness, overinflated sense of self, is really what is being dissected. And it's being done maybe with an ironic, sarcastic approach, or maybe simply because this is the electorate or the citizens have taken this to such degree at face value that the writer cannot do anything but try to explore it in some way without it ever really being brought down. But I think that American exceptionalism, in the end, is what makes American literature unexceptional. Mm. And I don't say this in a demeaning way. I think that any literary tradition that connects to a nation is in itself exceptional. That what that nation's, the Germans, the Russians, the Argentines, want to do is to show what makes them Argentines or Russians or Germans, what distinguishes them from everybody else. So they are exceptional. They are different. They might not believe that God has granted them, as he did to the Israelites in the Bible, a special status the way Americans do. But they do think that the Argentine literature has certain qualities that distinguishes it from Uruguayan literature or Brazilian literature or from British literature. And the same thing with other nations. Here we have swallowed the message whole and thought that there is this almost view that God is walking next to us, ahead of everybody else, as if we are destined to have a future that is way superior to everybody else. But what American writers do is question this at the very core. What is the life of the ghetto? what does it say about American exceptionalism and the mafia and political corruption? Are we really exceptional, or is this a trick that we tell ourselves in order to feel that this country is unique and different and called to perform certain tasks that others don't see for themselves?
Right. So I'm fascinated by this idea about the stories that groups of people tell themselves in order to create an identity or a nation. And we're in the middle now of this war in Ukraine. And one of the first things that struck me when the news started coming out was that hearing that Russians were being told and believing that they were denazifying this country. And I kind of thought, Nazis, where does that come from? Like, are they crazy? What are they even thinking? And then, of course, I connected it to, oh, that's their moment of great triumph. That's the, World War II being this call to glory. And it's been a sustaining, self-conception that they go in and they beat Nazis. And my first thought was, it made them seem almost brainwashed to me. But then I thought about my own life and the way that I've looked at being an American. And I can remember when I first went abroad and I was telling people, oh, Americans, we're, and I was taking this story from something my father had told me. It's sort of a primitive history lesson, but it was like, oh, in America, we had a revolution and we were fighting behind trees and we weren't wearing these bright red uniforms and marching in formation. We were always the sneaky ones and the plucky ones who were pragmatic and doing what it takes to win. Of course, that has no connection to myself or my ancestors, or there's no reason why I should think that I'm plucky or resourceful or anything like that based on what had happened hundreds of years ago. But I viewed it as part of my identity. And it's interesting to me that these stories are so powerful in moving people and helping people to kind of identify as something and feel like they're part of a community. But it seems like literature always challenges that. And always says, well, is that really who you are? Or are you really, it's a more complicated story than that. And that makes me wonder if literature does define who we are, or if it's always just sort of telling us what's wrong with the definitions that we're trying to find through our oral traditions or in our history lessons or when we listen to political speeches and so on.
I would say the latter. I think that the task of literature is not to answer, but to question.
Yeah.
And to question in ways that lead to other questions. So that we are, we ponder through a literary character with the empathy that we feel for that character, if the reality that we have built for ourselves makes sense, or if it's like an entanglement of suggestions and lies and self-delusions. We live at a time when popular culture has an astonishing power. Superheroes, comic strips, graphic novels, commercials, Netflix, Hollywood. And there is often the belief that literature is losing ground, diminishing its status in the expansion that this popular field is having. And there's no doubt that fewer people read now than read in other periods, or maybe the same amount of people, but there are more people now. In any event, the book is in crisis. But I don't think that it will ever disappear. The book serves a function that no other narrative can fulfill, and that is that it pushes the imagination of the reader to go in directions that are uncontrolled. The writer might suggest, but a good writer pushes us to wander and wander on our own. With a Raskolnikov in Crime and Punishment, or with a Don Quixote in The Masterpiece by Cervantes, and we feel that we are Don Quixote or that we are Raskolnikov. That is what attracts us to those books. I think that the literature is about those nuances, about the contradictions of characters, about the fact that they can be telling the truth, but they're also liars, because all of us are liars and also want to tell the truth. And we oscillate between the two. While you were speaking, I was thinking of a word that I hear with astonishing frequency recently, especially among my students and young people, and that is gaslighting. As a non-native, I have to confess that I did not know what gaslighting was. That's right. It wasn't until my students called my attention to the movie that they defined it to me as if they were Merriam-Webster itself or the OED, that I realized the impact that this word has, the way it describes the world in which we live, trying to make others believe that the reality in which you exist is fractured or it's not accurate, competing realities. And that is what, if we still, at the end of the book, I wonder if we still have a nation. After it's a book written during the Trump years, and it seems to me that the fracturing of America took place during those 4 years in a way that it had been much more dramatic than anything that happened from the Civil War to the present. And I frankly fear that with the gaslighting idea that there is an election that is inconclusive still, that there is a considerable portion of the electorate that believes that President Biden is illegitimate, that he didn't win in a straight and in convincing fashion, that we are living not in one universe, but in a multiverse, or at least in parallel realities. And so does that mean that we are about to enter another civil war, or does that mean that we have two different literatures?
Yeah.
A literature that satisfies one type of the population and a very different type has a very different literature. When you have two literary traditions, do you still have one country? It seems to me that the schism, the abyss, is right before us, and it's frightening.
Because it's not just we can't agree on basic facts, but we also seem to have this hard time right now with the need to define other people in a way that doesn't make sense to them. And I feel like in some ways that's the gaslighting that gets me the most. And I'm sure that everyone on either side or on all sides feel like that's happening to them. But it's sort of this, somebody who might support a Democrat or Democratic causes. And what they hear on the other side is, well, that must mean that you love pedophilia and you must be you must want open borders and you're a baby killer and, you know, all of these things. And people might say, well, you know, that wasn't I was interested in helping the climate and trying to get jobs for people. And I wasn't really thinking about transgender bathrooms and I wasn't really thinking about, you know, but you must be X. And it's kind of part of this culture war. I'm sure people on the other side think, well, I was just trying to get, you know, less regulation and lower taxes. And here you are calling me X, Y, and Z. And it feels like instead of thinking, who are we and what makes us special, what makes us different, it's almost like we've turned it on one another. And it's all, well, here's who you are. And I'm going to define myself by saying, I'm not part of you, even though you're living in this same territory that I am.
Yeah. A year or two ago, the word of the year that Merriam-Webster included or proposed to everybody at the end of the year, they always have the most popular or the one that the most defined the previous 12 months was the word day. Because we are now hesitant to use the word he or she. But it seems to me that the real word that is in crisis is the word we. We have absolutely lost the trust that in that word we, all sorts of different persuasions, all sorts of different beliefs can fit in. And instead, we have broken that word we into opposing bands that do not have trust. When, if you want to have a nation, if we set ourselves the exercise, let's start a new nation for ourselves. So what would we need? Well, we would need, I think, a territory, although it's not essential, but, you know, there. I was talking about Jewish literature. Jewish literature doesn't have a territory. We would need a flag. We would need a national bank. We would need a post office. We would probably need one or two national languages, and we would need a shared history or a shared mythology that would bring us all together. And that shared mythology would help us in kind of build ourselves around the concept that we have something in common, that we trust each other. But when that mythology is broken and becomes the alternative mythologies with their own heroes and the anti-heroes, then what you are seeing is really a breaking apart of the sense of togetherness. So that word we, to me, is the one that seems to be incredibly elusive these days. Mm-hmm. Who are we? Is there really still a we the people? Or is it an us and them the people? And that's dangerous.
Well, that actually does give me at least a little bit of hope for literature, even though, as we've been talking about, literature, the content of it doesn't necessarily lend itself to this, because it's always asking us to challenge assumptions, and it's asking us to question a kind of groupthink that might be part of a nation coming together and defining itself. But it also seems like when we can't agree on politics and we have issues there, there are things, I'm thinking of nations that look to a favorite author, for example, and define themselves and say, well, we're the nation of Shakespeare, or we're proud of Dante, or we're proud of Pushkin. And Americans, you know, they might, even for all of our differences, we still watch the NFL, and we still have Super Bowl Sunday, and we still have Thanksgiving, and we still have moments where we are building a kind of tradition together that maybe can be a basis for a reawakening of unity and common ground. And I'm hopeful that there's some literature in there. I don't know if enough people read it and engage with it and enjoy it to be, you know, as big as something like, well, we all watched Seinfeld when that was on, or we all did, you know, other kind of, we all listened to Prince, or, you know, something like that. But I wonder if there could be an author, or if we have something that's been on the syllabi that we all have valued that might serve that kind of a role.
Your question is very sobering, and it makes me think that were he alive and were we to ask Shakespeare what he thought of the fact that we use his name to describe the entire age that he represents. And my impression is that he would laugh. He never thought of himself as the one that was channeling all the ghosts, all the hopes of an era. In fact, you know, he was just one more playwright. Playwriting was not supposed to be for the future. It was only for the present. He never even wanted his plays to be published. Only his poetry, because poetry is really what mattered in the years to come. And yet now we call the Elizabethan era the Shakespeare age. And maybe there is a writer out there that we don't know that is doing something that we in the present are yet incapable of seeing. And this person is shrewd enough to capture the many contradictions that are defining us in ways that will go far beyond our inconsistencies and our, nearsightedness. It is fitting that we don't know who will represent us. The future will decide that. I'm hoping that Tom Brady is only for the present, but Tom Brady will fade, and somebody in literature, not in the NFL, will come to describe the contradictions that we experience. And it's probably somebody who's in the margins, who is very observant, who has a capacity to use language in a way that we think pedantic at this point, or not quite fitting, but in the end will survive in ways that many of us will not.
That is wonderfully put. I will keep my fingers crossed and my eyes open and hope that we see such a figure. Professor Elin Stavins, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me again.
Okay, that's going to do it for this episode of the History of Literature. Wasn't that great? I can't wait to dive into some more American literature. We have at least one great white whale we haven't yet harpooned, and no, I'm not talking about Herman Melville. I'll let you guess, but it's not hard to guess. But that is in the works. What else can we promise? How about Kierkegaard and the Diary of a Seducer? And we will have a compilation soon on writers and war, and some more Henry James. Speaking of Americans, he's certainly one of the best. William Blake is coming up soon, too. That was a fun one. And Edward Gibbon, the classic historian. And maybe we need to hear some more, or some, for the first time, June Jordan. And maybe a swerve into Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment. Is that a swerve? More like a plunge. That's me, your humble plunger. Oh. Wait, that's not exactly all that flattering, is it? Reminds me of my friend who wrote a note to her professor and said, "Your ideas have been like fertilizer for my brain." I suggested an edit, which hopefully helped. "Your ideas have helped my mind flourish, like shit being spread on flowers." Well, no. No, I didn't suggest that, dear listeners. I can be obtuse, but I'm not crude or cruel. I think my edit was, well, wait. Who cares? Who cares what it was? Who cares what anything was? Who cares who I am other than me, maybe? And yet here I am, and yet here I go, once again, saying for the X-hundredth time, I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.